Fat Segundo here, and I'm feeling very vengeful towards the blackguards who sought to mangle my voice in the last podcast. I was asked to offer voice samples as part of my contract with the people who run this show. They promised me a few hundred dollars. Well, it appears that their efforts failed them, and I'm here once again, lured by the promise of triple my pay. Now I'm a simple man with a simple philosophy. Full bat once, shame on you. Full bat twice, then you're hosting a rinky-dink podcast, goddamn. But all this is unimportant. For this week, we have a real man on our show. A guy who apparently knows rocks and a few other things as well, named Simon Winchester. And as our young loving correspondent discovered, he's so hardcore in his expertise that he's willing to overlook human lives. Well, that's all fine and dandy, but I can still drink this Winchester guy under the table.
Okay, I am here with Simon Winchester, author of many books, and most recently, A Crack in the Edge of the World. Simon, how are you doing?
I'm doing extremely well, rather weary at the middle point of a long, long book tour, yes. But no, I'm in fine fettle.
I'm wondering if they took you, why San Francisco was in the middle, as opposed to, you know, seeing as how this ties into the book in question.
A very good point. I mean, where have I been so far? Twice in California in the past 3 weeks, so I've crossed the country now 6 times in 3 weeks. And Des Moines, which doesn't have any particular interest in earthquakes, and Fresno. But I think the idea was that San Francisco probably bought the hardback of the book. And so to ask a somewhat earthquake-weary populace to buy yet another book, but in paperback, might be slightly overdoing it. So let's get the market that is more likely to buy it over with first, and then put in 3 or 4 solid days in San Francisco to really squeeze the last little bit of juice out of this particular lemon.
Sounds like a fan. Well, anyway, I wanted to talk about San Francisco, since we're here, and since you're in San Francisco, and since the book deals with San Francisco. You view San Francisco from the top of Mount Diablo, which is a very beautiful mountain. I've been there once myself, and the word vulnerable flashed into your mind as you write in the book. And you specifically write that San Francisco suffers under a greater sense of edgy impermanence than any other great city anywhere. But what makes San Francisco more vulnerable than, say, Venice, which is sinking, or the various cities which lie along the North Sea in Holland?
I think because what's happening to Venice and what's happening in the North Sea has been happening for a long time and slowly and undramatically. Whereas San Francisco, 3 times in its settled history and many times in its unsettled history, has suffered unpredicted, very sudden and dramatic episodes, which have, in the 3 times when it's been populated, have essentially destroyed the city. So its edgy impermanence, I think, derives from the fact that sooner or later that's going to happen again. It's not a slow process of attrition. Yeah. It's an occasional sudden and very dramatic moment of utter destruction.
Sure, sure, absolutely. And of course, this city came into being rather quickly, as you point out in the book, too.
It's a city that was never a town. It went from a village of 50, 100, 200 people to a settled community of something like 250,000 people, and more, indeed, 400,000 by the time the earthquake struck in 1906. It never was a middle-ranking town like Omaha. Mm-hmm. It suddenly became a city.
Absolutely. Well, you also cite several examples in this book of Mears, Oklahoma, New Madrid, Missouri. Basically, you know, where often the most important historical event in these towns is, in fact, this great sort of seismic activity. I was wondering if this is your way of suggesting that geology is something that humanity is overlooking needlessly, perhaps.
Well, there is that famous old adage that mankind exists on this planet subject to geological consent, which can be withdrawn at any time. And I like that point of view, to look at mankind's existence on this earth as something of a privilege that can be withdrawn suddenly and capriciously by an earth that we mercifully understand rather more than we did, for instance, when San Francisco was settled. And I think it's an important point because it should persuade us as human settlers to build our cities in places where they should be built. And that's an interesting feature, I think, of, for instance, Europe and Asia, which is littered with the ruins of cities that were built where they should not have been built. So Pompeii and Petra Heliopolis, Ayutthaya, they were all cities that were glorious in their time, but which were built where nature shouldn't in the long term allow them to be built. And the thing about America, particularly uniquely, is that there are no ruins in this country. There are a few ruined ghost towns in Nevada and Utah and places like that. But there are no ruined cities because America is a country so young and so imbued with hubris and self-confidence that it has put its cities down where she jolly well wishes to build them, yeah, without any consideration of whether they should, they're built in places that were appropriate. And I wonder whether if you were to draw a map of America, let's say 200 years from now, whether the urban geography might not be significantly different from what it is today, whether some cities that exist today will have been abandoned in just the way that Petra and Heliopolis were abandoned. One has to wonder, for instance, at the wisdom, when you look at it in the long perspective, of building a city like New Orleans, a city in a swamp, 20 feet below sea level, in a part of the world that you know is afflicted with constant, highly destructive hurricanes and tidal surges. Similarly, how wise is it to build cities like Tucson and Phoenix and even Las Vegas? I mean, there's no great global tradition of cities surviving for very great periods of time that have been built in the middle of deserts. I mean, there is no water there. Yeah. So what will happen to them? And then, of course, one has to consider San Francisco, because here now, given what we know, it's built on top of, not 50 miles to the east or the west of, but on top of the San Andreas Fault, which is one of the most mobile and dangerous tectonic plate boundaries on the planet. Was this a wise place to build a city? Well, of course, we didn't know in 1849. We do now. So how is San Francisco going to deal with the inevitable?
Well, speaking of hubris, you take the residents of Portola Valley to task for living pretty much right on the fault. But I'm wondering if this is a sort of situation where humanity, or the residents that live here, simply cannot understand that the age of the Earth versus their sort of rather comparatively fleeting kind of existence is, and what maybe we can do to sort of, you know, allow people to understand that there is this great sort of geological basis. Is this where guys like you come in? Or?
Well, although funnily enough, last time I was here, I did a talk at a bookstore on Market Street, and there was a white envelope on the podium, and I thought, oh, how nice, the bookseller has given me a check. But it was not a check. Never is a check. It was simply an anonymous typed letter, and of course they're always anonymous, from a reader, or at least someone who knew I was there, saying very angrily, why don't people like you just go away? We don't want to know about the inevitability of earthquakes here. We are perfectly happy. This is one of the most beautiful places in America. And frankly, Mr. Winchester, I each evening uncork a bottle of Chardonnay, or I uncork or unscrew a bottle of Pinot Noir, and I raise a glass in the direction of the sunset over the Farallon Islands, and I think how blessed I am to live in such a beautiful part of the world. And fie on you for saying that this is a dangerous place to live. I just don't want to know. So I have to reply, I'm afraid, denial like that is a problem, because not even a vat, not even a crate, not even a wagon load of Chardonnay is going to alleviate your problems if and when a big earthquake occurs. The country that has learned to deal with earthquakes very well indeed, and from which I think San Francisco should take some learning, is Japan. Mm-hmm. Here is a country which for 2,500 years has sat at one of the most dangerous seismic crossroads on the planet. It has built over the centuries in materials that are inexpensive, flexible, easily replaceable, and in modern times has built intelligently and moreover has trained its people. From their mother's milk, the Japanese learn what to do in the event of a major vibration in the earth. There's no denial. The people that are in charge of the emergency planning in every village, in every town, in every prefecture, every city, know what to do. There's no one of the incompetence that, for instance, was displayed after Hurricane Katrina on duty in Japan. The consequence is that when you get these big earthquakes, inevitably they occur. The great Kanto earthquake of 1923, which effectively destroyed Tokyo, is going to hit again, but Tokyo will survive. At the moment, it can't be said with absolute certitude that San Francisco will recover from a major, and I'm talking about 9 or above, earthquake that probably will one day hit this city. So that is a problem. Think Japanese is the answer.
Gotcha. Well, going back to this anonymous letter, a Portola Valley resident might argue, well, seeing as how the big one is going to happen sometime between now and 2023, what should I worry about? I'll be dead by then. it's like living in danger versus, you know, living with utter certainty that this big major seismic occurrence is actually going to happen. So again, I go back to this issue of like, how does the importance, how does it relate to the public? How are people actually able to live with themselves? It's actually, in its own weird way, quite similar to our current sort of post 9/11 life with terrorism, you know, where we're in constant fear, you know?
Yes, there is a sort of a subliminal fear here, which does not exist in, let's say, New York, where I live, or Massachusetts, where I've got a farm, because these are seismically stable corners of the world. But here there's an edginess which one might argue adds to the sort of the timbre of the city. It makes it a more exciting place to live, and it certainly makes for much better scenery. But one has to remember that with scenery, with mountains, with, you know, great embayments, with spectacular countryside, the reason that their countryside is spectacular is because almighty geological forces created it. So every mountain chain in the world, the Himalayas, the Alps, the mountains in the Atlas Mountains in Morocco, they were all caused by great tectonic upheavals, and the same with the Sierra and the California and coast here. It's beautiful because it's dangerous, but people choose to live here, therefore, because they want beauty, so therefore they voluntarily court danger. And I think here, additionally, they like the edginess that the danger affords them.
Sure, sure. It takes a certain type of person to live
here. It does, absolutely.
That's why we've had a history of people like, you know, Emperor Norton and the like.
And exactly, and they would not wish to go and live in Nebraska, where you would just die of boredom.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, actually, let's go to this book, because it's a really rather unusual book that you have, because it's like part travelogue, part sort of history of California, and then part sort of geological treatise. What was the sort of launching point, the impetus that sort of launched the book? Was it the travelogue? Was it just another sort of geological dirge here? Or?
Yeah, I think geology had a lot to do with it. I had been a geologist at Oxford back in the 1960s. I abandoned geology, became first a journalist and then a full-time author. And then, for a very complicated reason, after I had a book come out called The Professor and the Madman, which was relatively successful, my editor came to me and said, let us analyze why this book was a success. And it turned out that the central character of that book was a hitherto unknown person who made a major contribution to human society. The trajectory of his life was dramatically up and down, and because he mutilated himself very badly in the later years of his life, there was also grotesque bodily mutilation. So my editor said, can you think of another person that fills those four criteria? And I said, Larry, he was called Larry Ashmead, you know, what sort of a person do you think I am? Of course I can't think. He said, no, think, you might think of somebody. Well, blow me down, I did. And he said, weren't you once a geologist? And I remembered my tutor at Oxford telling me about a man called William Smith. William Smith was the inventor of the first ever geological map of the world back in 1815. I looked him up in Britannica, and it said, Smith William, born Churchill, Oxfordshire, 1769, creator of the first ever geological map. And then there were five sentences which whetted my appetite because they sort of matched the criteria in The Professor and the Madman. He was plagiarized. He went bankrupt. He went to debtor's prison. His wife went mad. She became a nymphomaniac. And with that word nymphomaniac, I thought, my God, this is as bizarre and unexpected as the grotesque bodily mutilation that I discovered when doing The Professor and the Madman. Maybe that'll fit the bill. And the editor said, yes, that'd be superb. So that made me become totally fascinated in and write a book about an early geologist. That book did remarkably well, unexpectedly well, because I'm a book about geology, who'd want to buy it? But because of that, someone said to me, in fact, I think it probably was my editor or maybe my agent, well, the public seemed to like geology. What about doing a book about a major geological event? And so I thought, why not? The most important geological event that I can remember was the eruption of Krakatoa in 1883, an almighty volcano between Java and Sumatra. So I did that, and that did rather well. So then let's have another major geological event, and that's what brought me to San Francisco. And it happened to be that as I was finishing Krakatoa, so it was evident that I was approaching the centenary of San Francisco, and that was an obviously good peg to hang it on.
We actually had, of course, you know, the centennial celebration here, where the bells were rang at a very ungodly hour.
5:12
yeah,
in the morning.
Exactly,
right.
Yes, yes. So I figured I'd be awake and actually attend that. However, this stands in contrast to the efforts a certain historian trying to actually get a plaque in Daly City, where the true epicenter of the 1906 earthquake is. And I wanted to ask you, what do you think accounts for these two completely obverse reactions here?
Oh, I think total stupidity on the behalf of the people or the administration of Daly City. I mean, there is no doubt Bruce Bolt, who sadly died a couple of years ago, wrote a definitive paper establishing from the 90-odd seismogram records of the earthquake where the epicenter was. And it used to be thought that it was in Olema, north of San Francisco. And indeed, if you go to this little town near Point Reyes, you'll see souvenir shops and, you know, T-shirts saying I was at the epicenter and hats saying epicenter. It wasn't the epicenter at all. The epicenter, according to Bruce Bolt's calculations, which I'm sure are correct, lies between the shore and a little islet called Muscle Rock in Daly City. And so the geological community and some wise residents of Daly City thought this was wonderful. Let's put up a plaque showing where the real, you know, calculated epicenter of this major event was. And blow me down, and to their astonishment, the sort of stubborn and somewhat ignorant mayor and administration of Daly City said, no, we don't want people to come here. It'll be a damper on tourism. There is no tourism. No one in their right mind would ever go to Daly City for any other reason than commuting to and from it. It has no tourist attractions. Now it has, the epicenter of one of the most significant earthquakes in human history. But they turned it down. So boo to them, I say, and I think San Francisco is absolutely right to commemorate this event.
You didn't even mention Sal Torres by name, I noticed.
No, well, I did not, but I didn't want to libel or to otherwise trouble these people too much. Just I'd like a corporate acknowledgement that this is a place run by stupid people.
But Jim Tanner is a very interesting guy.
Jim Tanner is wonderful. He's the man that wanted to put up the monument, and he has his own reasons for doing so, and I think it's an admirable effort.
He says he'll put it on his tombstone if they don't accept it.
Well, that's perfectly good, yes, although I don't think he was in the epicenter.
Well, I wanted to actually ask you about the fact that you only devote 3 pages in this book to Loma Prieta. And that was interesting to me because I know Loma Prieta didn't actually occur on the San Andreas Fault, but on a sub-parallel fault. But we're talking about this sense of danger here in San Francisco, and certainly a more recent example. Look at the 1906 earthquake. It was a young population. San Francisco, by nature of its sort of, you know, coastal sort of place, is a kind of place where people constantly sort of come here and then leave. And so I'm wondering why, first of all, why Loma Prieta wasn't so much of a feature in this, and also, how does the actions along a parallel fault influence the main fault, San Andreas Fault? I didn't really get an answer in your book. And
no, because I think there isn't an answer. No one knows quite what a parallel fault rupture does to the main fault, which is one of the reasons that they're currently drilling a hole through the fault in a place called Parkfield near Paso Robles. And that is to work out what does happen at depth, because there is a lot of continuous movement in and around Parkfield, unlike what happens in Northern California, where the fault is essentially locked solid. I also think that there should be a hole drilled into the fault here, where it is locked, but that would be extremely expensive and possibly even dangerous. As to why I didn't cover Loma Prieta in great detail, I believed then, and I still believe now, that 3 pages was probably enough. I mean, I had given so much space to eyewitness accounts of the event itself in 1906 that there is only so much you can say about the catastrophe or disaster or crashing or dying. And there is a sense of ennui, I think, develops. I wanted much more to write about things that explained and talk about aftermath and talk about social ramifications than produce a litany of eyewitness reports of catastrophe. This book is a book that uses a disaster to tell a bigger story, and I think that was my reasoning.
Well, at the same time, you mentioned that nobody knows what influence a parallel fault will have on the main one, and this goes back to, you know, the idea that, I mean, Eldridge Moore's new geology is only 30 years old, or 35 years old, rather. And I'm wondering, you know, given that, is there any real sort of way of knowing? Are we still operating in our own way, just in the dark, about this question of being able to track activity? You note in this book how people are really trying to sort of come up with the ultimate answer where we can absolutely pinpoint the precise time, precise date, precise Richter scale rating, you know?
Things are moving very rapidly. I mean, the USGS particularly, they've got a lot of money in the last 3 years from the National Science Foundation. One of the things that they're doing is the Parkfield experiment, which is very important, called SAFOD, the San Andreas Fault Observed at Depth. But also they're doing a major study of the entire plate boundary and the edge of the North American plate, looking at the microscopic movement of mountains from northwest Washington state right down to Southern California. The rate of learning is extraordinary at the moment. And largely, of course, because of the interest in seismology sparked by the earthquake in 06, which, you know, caused the foundation of the Seismological Society of America. The one thing that everyone's chasing, of course, is the ability to predict. But they haven't come within an ace of it yet. And even if they did, one would argue, you know, what is the point of issuing a prediction if you can only give a city like this, let's say, 48 hours notice? I mean, the freeways would be clogged, there would be chaos and panic.
Again, like the tsunami alerts, too.
Indeed, yes. So it might be basically prepare people for what to do rather than warn them with very short time to get out when they think one is coming. And what would happen if one was predicted and it didn't come? Then the next time it was predicted, people would stay put and who knows what would happen to them.
Well, I wanted to actually ask you about this project in the San Andreas Fault and how it was very interesting to actually finally learn how the fault was split up into north, central, and south. But you impute in this book that perhaps the drillings in the center, they may be responsible in some sense for the September 28th, 2004 Parkfield earthquake, and that this stands as this kind of dispute between laymen or the residents of Parkfield versus the geologists who really want to understand the fault, but there's a certain kind of risk of sort of unearthing some great tremor that might have problems later. So what is the exact danger here in terms of, you know, actually placing or drilling things into a fault?
I am told, I mean, well, I know only what I'm told, but I'm told there is no danger whatsoever. That you would have to drill thousands of much, much bigger holes. I mean, what is happening is, people used to say that drilling a deep hole is rather like suspending a needle on the end of a cotton thread down a drain pipe of a house in the hope of burying that needle in the earth. It's a very difficult thing to do. In the scale of things, this hole is microscopically small. And the thought that it could do in any way could trigger an event of so much kinetic and thermal energy being released from the pent-up tensions in the rock, I think is nonsense. It's just too small. It's too insignificant to have an effect. People who know little about seismology say, of course it could trigger an effect. You only need, you know, it is literally the straw that broke the camel's back. But I think they're talking nonsense. I think the observations, the benefits from the observations at depth are enormous, and the risks infinitesimally small.
Gotcha, but at the same time, we don't entirely understand the relation between a parallel fault and a main fault. So one might argue that, you know, we're sort of kind of stumbling about in the dark, trying to figure out how the great tectonic plate system works.
Yes, but I think it needs to be put in perspective. We don't know fully. We know a great deal more than we knew in 1965 of the mechanics and the geometry. But it is laughable to think that such a small intrusion into the fault could have any effect at all. I think it's, yes, I accept what you say, we don't know. But the probability is very low indeed that it has any effect at all.
Certainly. Okay. I actually wanted to bring up a very interesting review I read of this book from Brian Burrow in the New York Times Book Review. He called you the Kenny G of popular history. And he specifically complained about the sort of digressive nature of the book and not understanding what the Gaia theory had to do with the San Francisco earthquake, and pointing out that this book didn't particularly have any specific sort of character. Now, I wanted to actually ask if you had a certain kind of difficulty finding focus, or whether this is sort of intended to kind of be as much of a kind of digressive kind of skip-hop as the history of geology of the last 100 years was.
I had no difficulty finding focus. I mean, the plan for the book, I set it down before I wrote it, and I think more or less faithfully I adhered to it. The Brian Burrow review, which was savage, I think one can fairly say.
It was more about him than you.
It was very ad hominem, I think, and it was the only, there was a somewhat indifferent review in the Wall Street Journal, but it was a very, very bad review in the Times. Brian Burrow, who I know nothing about, knows nothing about and has no interest in geology. And for him to say, I don't know the relation between the Gaia theory and the earthquake, or talking about the earthquake, I mean, it's just nonsense. I mean, he's displaying his ignorance. And I still rankle. I mean, I haven't thought of the review for a year now. It's very kind of you to bring it up. But I think it was a foolish review, quite frankly. And I take my lumps if it's a considered bad review. But if it's an ill-considered and ad hominem review written by a man who regrettably is somewhat of a failure in his writing career, then I don't quite take it quite as seriously as I might. New York Times Book Review is trying for a new audience at the moment under the editor Sam Tannenhaus. And it sometimes offers reviews which are somewhat eccentric. And I think this was an example of one. So I obviously, like a tiger defending her young, will defend my book. And but regrettably, you know, if you get a bad review, you just have to lie back and take it. There's nothing one can do about it. But I do think that was an unfair review. I mean, and he didn't know enough about the subject. I think he shouldn't really have been given the book to review.
Sure. But this also goes back to one of our earlier questions, in the sense that, and I would agree with you, that most of the bad reviews I read about this book were people who had no real interest in geology. So what do we do to these people? Are these people just sort of a kind of, you know, a sort of part of humanity and of their own? Or, I mean, what can you do to sort of illustrate the importance of geology to people?
Well, I think, without wanting to get on a soapbox or rant about it, I think geology is hugely important. It underpins, quite literally, everything we do. I mean, every piece of wood, every morsel of iron, every bit of oil and coal and gas, it all comes from the Earth. We need to study and sympathetically study the planet on which we live. And of course, that's central to the Gaia theory. To dismiss it as being a boring subject, which of course, because it was taught so badly in universities, is what many of us do, I think now is being short-sighted. And it's very kind of you to say that the bad reviews, of which mercifully there weren't many, tended to be written by people who think geology is bunk anyway. Yeah. So they're unlikely to be sympathetic to any book, whether it's written by me or John McPhee or Philip Fradgen or whoever. It's just a book about geology is ipso facto a bad book. So I have no particular problem. I have a problem with the New York Times, because that is, after all, the major showcase review in the country. And to be given a bad review by then is something that stings.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, as Oscar Wilde said, you can let a bad review ruin your breakfast, but don't let it ruin your lunch.
I wanted to bring up Kevin Starr, and I'm a big fan of his California Dream books, and I noted in the scope of this particular book, it was very Starr-like, and then I flipped back to the appendix, and I was like, oh, did Winchester actually read Starr? And then I see that there was, like, six books listed. I mean, you have a scope that includes the racism of the Chinese who were here, Angel Island,
I mean,
and all
towards
that.
The Chinese, towards not of the Chinese.
Yeah, sorry, you know what I mean. I'm wondering how much Starr was an influence on putting this book together, if it was the Starr books that in any specific way sort of inspired you to come up with this kind of great scope.
In a way, and oddly enough, when I moved to San Francisco, I was offered the chance to be a visiting professor at San Jose State for 4 months, and I lived, they provided me with a flat in San Francisco itself, and I would go down to San Jose twice a week. Turns out, 1835 Franklin Street, I was on the 16th floor, 15th floor, immediately below my flat, lived Kevin Starr. And so we would see each other a great deal, and whenever I was coming to a particularly interesting, as I saw it, part of the book, I would refer not only to his volumes, how he covered it, but would then speak to him and ring him up or invite him up for a drink. So I wasn't inspired at the beginning of the writing of the book by those six wonderful volumes, but as I read them and did more and more research, so they became enormously useful.
But did you feel that, like, because I noticed that a lot of the same sources that he cited in his books were cited in yours.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you possibly sort of, this may have been problematic to some degree in the sense of, like, you writing a Simon Winchester book, was there a sort of point where you kind of digressed from these meetings with Kevin Starr or these this influence? Or?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it was... No, I mean, his sources, yes, as you rightly say, were often sources that I used and extrapolated from those sources and came to my own, perhaps rather different conclusions from his. But no, he and his books were hugely useful to me.
I want to go back to Katrina and the comparisons. You actually wrote an article in the Telegraph communicating, you know, the comparisons between 1906 and Katrina. And in this book, you go into Mayor Schmidt and General Funston's reactions to the quakes, as well as, of course, the infamous $10,000 that was going to go to Italy and then had to come back.
Yes.
But you were somewhat sort of quiet concerning federal aid. And I'm wondering, you know, given your research, if you actually could possibly fill in the blanks on the federal aid question and possibly compare the really terrible reaction by FEMA to Katrina to the sort of circumstances in 1906.
Well, I think federal aid in 1906 was laudable. I mean, I think they organized it tremendously well. Once Schmitz had managed to send the telegram out from Oakland Telegraph Station to the White House, got there at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon local time in Washington, D.C., same day, April the 18th, the Wednesday of the earthquake, Teddy Roosevelt, William Taft, the Secretary of War, reacted with astonishing speed. Congress was called into emergency session more or less immediately. It passed an enabling act for the money that was needed for the relief operations at 4 o'clock the next morning. Relief trains were ordered out of the army depots in the east, you know, thundering their way westwards. By that afternoon, the first relief train arrived in Oakland on the very evening of the day of the earthquake, the 18th of April, sent on federal instruction from Los Angeles. So I think the major federal reaction to this earthquake was prompt, it was efficient, it was compassionate. And also smaller things like the postmaster of San Francisco saying that if he came across a letter or a card clearly from the hand of a victim which didn't have a stamp on it, then it could be passed and mailed no matter that it, you know, had no fee attached to it. So that kind of thing, the fact that within a week every tent in the American army was pitched in San Francisco, providing emergency housing for the homeless. Within 2 weeks, 1 in 10 of the entire American Standing Army was on duty in San Francisco. I think this shows that the federal reaction was efficient, laudable, something praiseworthy, compared to the lamentable reaction in 2005 at a time not only was America equipped with high technology, with cell phones, with satellites, with computers, with helicopters, but we saw the Katrina hurricane coming foot by foot, mile by mile, on our domestic television sets. The Weather Channel, CNN, showed this monster storm coming towards New Orleans. By contrast, in 1906, no one had the slightest idea there was going to be an earthquake. So an unprepared city and an unprepared nation reacted very well in 1906. A fully cognizant nation reacted appallingly in 2005. It was a different sort of intellectual attitude to the two events, and I find that an amazing and astonishing and fascinating reality.
I wanted to actually ask you about Schmitz's order about the looters. Many people, including novelist James D'Alessandro, who authored a book, 1906, which I noticed you didn't reference, but a less dubious source, Dan Kurtzman, who wrote another book on the 1906 earthquake, they have provided prognostication and evidence that suggests that 500 people were shot and killed. And you contend in this book that three people were shot that only a few handful of people were shot. But there's also, of course, newspaper reports. There's the deaf fireman, for example, who couldn't hear and was apparently shot. And there are all sorts of things. I mean, I'm wondering why you decided on the smaller figure supported by the city as opposed to this larger 500 figure, which, I mean, we'll never really know exactly how many there were, and it's very possible that it was considerably more than 500.
Because this is not that kind of book. I don't care whether martial law was ordered or not. I don't care whether too many buildings were blown up or not. I'm interested in the geology, the physics, the religious reaction, the political reaction, America's sort of corporate reaction to the earthquake. I'm interested in the relevance and importance of the earthquake in global terms, which is why I started the book looking at the planet from space to see, to try and imagine the importance of this in the global scheme of things. These sort of minute pinpricks may fascinate the people of San Francisco. They don't fascinate or even interest me in the slightest. It's just not what the book is about.
But certainly in terms of the greater sort of scope, I mean, you know...
It has no relevance at all to the great scope, whether it was 700 people died, 500 people, 5,000 people died. 275,000 people died in the Sumatran tsunami of 2 years ago. That is a major event. 225,000 people died in the Tianjin earthquake in eastern China in the same year that Mao Zedong died, 1978 or 79. These are major seismic events. The San Francisco event was a minor seismic event, but a major social event and a major scientific event that had huge importance on American history, because it was the first time in world history that we stopped looking at these catastrophes as the work of a malevolent god and started to look at them as a natural event which should be explained. And so instead of unleashing priests on the problem, which we did in Lisbon in 1755 and after Krakatoa, mullahs there, because it was Islamic, in 1883, we unleashed on the orders of the then Republican governor of California, Mr. Pardee, a rather dull dentist, we unleashed scientists. And scientists gave us answers. And those answers are of such profound importance that niggling around with whether it was 500 or 50 or 300, whether they were shot, whether they were died under falling buildings, whether there was a deaf fireman, are so unimportant. They're the stuff of tabloid journalism. They're not the stuff of history. What I was attempting to grapple with in this book was a historical series of realities, why this was an important earthquake. And whether or not the casualty figures were 1,000 or 5,000 is more or less irrelevant. It was the aftermath, the impact on human society generally, that is important.
So in covering any sort of moment in history, it's not necessarily the fatality.
You don't cover moments in history. Journalists cover moments. Historians look back on them with perspective and have, I think, a wider view which does not encompass the tiny details of whether there was a deaf fireman shot. It's of no consequence whatsoever.
But what I'm trying to ask you in this sort of sense, what concerns you as a historian is not necessarily the fatalities, but the actual impact on human history.
Precisely.
This is always more importance than a number of people who die.
Yes, that's exactly right. And so, you know, Philip Fradkin and people who wrote admirable books on a different aspect of this, people that complained that Funston's policy of blowing up more buildings than he might have done, or Schmitz's legality or otherwise of his martial law order, or the order to use federal troops to fire on potential looters. I mean, all of this is fine and dandy, but it doesn't interest me. I mean, people that want that can buy another book.
Sure.
That's it is not of historical significance in the larger context.
But what if, for example, like, you know, like whorehouses and things like this, and pointing on, like, for example, we were talking about nymphomaniacs earlier. This was the Hotel Nymphomania. Details like that seem to be important, at least in chronicling this tale.
I didn't give an architectural drawing of the Hotel Nymphomania. I just, in passing, mentioned that it existed. I gave it, I believe, its appropriate weight in the story, which is feather-like weight. But it's the kind of thing that, when you write about it, makes people say, oh, that's amusing, that's interesting, and move on. It doesn't interrupt the narrative. We don't dwell on a fact like this. This was a rambustious, lascivious, louche city in 1906. The existence of the Hotel Nymphomania indicates that, and I believe somewhat lightly it was mentioned, but I think appropriately.
I'm just curious, one last question, and that is, how do you know how important a detail is? Do you have to sort of like think about it or ruminate upon it for a good deal of time, or do you have to sort of really sort of look at it through multiple prisms to find out exactly how historically influential it was, or?
I think so. I mean, I think the way I try and write is to produce in the description of the earthquake a sort of pointillist portrait. Little details that you think, when taken as a whole, give a fair evocation of what happened. And how I choose those, how any writer chooses some and disregards others. I mean, for instance, I have no particular interest in repeating yet again the story of the Bank of America, I mean, which it doesn't appear in the book at all. And a number of people say, why don't you produce this time-honored story? Well, because it's time-honored, because it's a cliche, because we know it only too well. So I tried to produce a lot of relatively new and unexpected things that give color and atmosphere to this one event. How you choose it, I suppose that is what marks one writer off from another. And you can be disliked by some reviewers and liked by others. The choices you make determine the quality of the book, and the reputation of you as a writer stands or falls on the basis of those choices.
Well, Simon Winchester, thank you very much.
Thank you. This was fun. Thank you so much. Thanks.